thank you very much for coming to All Are Honored to Talk. My name is Tamila Lankin. I'll be chairing this event. I'm the associate professor in the International Relations Department here. I teach Russian and Eurasian politics. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Ola and be able to chair her talk. Ola is coming back to the LSE. She has a master's degree from the LSE. She went on to do a PhD at Oxford. And since then, she's become a real star in terms of the academic coverage of the Russia-Ukraine crisis, of Ukrainian politics. She's published one book already on the comparative politics of protest. And she's now working on her second book. And today, she will be presenting results of her research that she's been conducting over the years, based on surveys, interviews, that kind of in-depth field work in Ukraine. So she'll speak for about 40 minutes, and then we'll open it for questions. Thank you. So the floor is yours. Great.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Tamila, John, for inviting me, and thank you, all of you, for coming here and listening to what I have to say, and hopefully it will be thought-provoking at least, yeah? So this isn't what typically I would do as an academic. Typically I would have this research question, hypothesis, here's the data I collected, here's how I analyze, you know, a little bit more formulaic. I'm trying out something new, but I think what I'm going to be talking to you about today is in fact based on empirical research, but it's really important. And it's really important that we start getting things right. So I'm going to talk to you about the six myths of the Ukrainian crisis, or the 50 shades of gray, as I like to call it. Mm-hmm. So think back to 2004. There was a divisive election. Yeah, the country was divided into two, equal half, so it seems, versus the Viktor Yushchenko and Yanukovych. Fraud was alleged on Viktor Yanukovych's side, and there were, in fact, peaceful protests. This was truly a critical juncture when it comes to protest events and civic engagement in the region, right? It was very important as a mass mobilization for the region. But unfortunately, the situation fell into convenient stereotypes of one side of the country being this core Ukraine, nationalist Ukraine, and the other side being Russian-oriented Ukraine. And these binary truths were reproduced over time and again. And certainly that's how we then looked at the 2010 presidential elections. Mm-hmm. Similarly, pinpointing Tymoshenko against Viktor Yanukovych. Viktor Yanukovych ended up winning the 2010 presidential elections. And really, we could understand it if you buy this whole story, that it was the Orange Revolution villain that was elected. And he was a controversial president amongst many in Ukraine, not simply the opposition parties. That's very pixelated, I think that adds to the effect. But of course, in November 2013, there's this fear that Europe is losing Ukraine when his prime minister actually announces that they will not sign the EU association agreement. Again, reproducing convenient binary truths. And Europe does react, but not perhaps as strongly as we would have liked, some of us at least. And there is the start of a new wave of protests. They are initially small. They're organized by activists and students in the Maidan city center of Kyiv. But they are, in fact, joined by people who are very much not students very quickly. Unfortunately, these protests do fizzle out by around November 29th. Perhaps unfortunately being more, on November 29th to November 30th, there is a very severe repression of the peaceful protesters, at the time actually mostly journalists and students. And sorry that is again pixelated, but if any of you have a minute or two, try to Google the CCTV footage of how students and foreign journalists are being chased through the city center and then beaten. This is really exactly how it looks like. So I think it's a miscalculation on the part of the regime, big time. This produces a mass mobilization. It is estimated that 1.3 million to 800,000 individuals participated in this particular protest event, wave of protests, in Kyiv alone. Unfortunately, we remember it with the Wall of Fire. We remember when protesters turned to violent repertoires. That's how we recall these events. And we tended to focus on the perceived rise of right-wing nationalist organizations or participants. Unfortunately, this protest and I remind you, ends the climax of this protest, and then the unfortunate denouement is, in fact, when 100 protesters are shot and killed overnight in February. Then we have the problem of the runaway president, Viktor Yanukovych, seemingly having undergone negotiations, seeks refuge in Russia. And we have the little green men. First, in Crimea, we don't know what's happening, but soon enough we do. This leads to the annexation and a referendum, if you agree with this. Referendum, of course, puts the realities that you're choosing between as a Nazi version of reality versus, I think this is blue sky thinking, but I don't know. Clearly, this is how it's at least sold to the population of Crimea. Then you have Green Men Part 2 in Donetsk and Luhansk, similar tactics, except a different outcome. You have a war, and you have an ongoing war. And the war, it's very real, and the casualties of war are the people that, for instance, the separatists themselves are arguing that they are there to protect. And this is, just to take a moment, because many people's lives have been dramatically affected by this conflict. And unfortunately, as I say, it's the people that resided in the Donbas region, which is Donetsk and Luhansk provinces put together, and they are now either displaced peoples in Belarus, Russia, Poland, Moldova, and Romania, or actually the majority of them in other parts of Ukraine. This is hundreds of thousands of people. Now, I just wanted to make sure we're all on the same page before I start talking about other things. To convey the nuances and to understand the nuances of the Ukrainian crisis, I think we really need to unpack six central myths that have been reproduced in both our policy and academic accounts on Ukraine for now over two decades. And we need to examine how they impede not only our understanding of the roots of the crisis, but the possible solutions to it. The first myth, Ukraine is a country divided into two neat halves, pro-Russian Easterners and Russian-speaking and pro-European Ukrainian-speaking Westerners. Myth number two, pro-Russian politicians, and there is such a thing, in Ukraine had and continue to have vested interest in stronger ties in Russian politics, industry, and commerce. This is central to understanding why Yanukovych did not sign the association agreement. The Euromaidan was a mass mobilization that was contradictory, because we believe that the central claims of the protesters were both externally focused, as in closer ties with the EU and clouded with a variety of liberal rights and values, but it was also inwardly focused, or so we claim, that it was actually, and it should be understood as nationalist, ethno-nationalist, ethno-linguistic, and nationalist in orientation. The following myth is that the average Euromaidan participant was a West Ukrainian and a Ukrainian speaker, and East Ukrainians and Russian speakers were marginalized by the protests. Myth number five, and there's a few of them, there's only six. Pro-Russian nationalist sentiments were prominent in both Crimea and the Donbas, and we had historically strong Russian nationalist parties and organizations in both regions prior to 2014. And political popular support for Russian intervention was the same in Donbas and Crimea, and therefore these two instances are comparable, and our understanding of how this conflict takes place are comparable. And finally, Ukraine is a failed state, and you can find academic and newspaper articles about this. Not only is it a failed state, but it is a state where divisions between ethno-linguistic groups continue to grow and remain the most salient predictor of policy preferences, be it foreign policy or language policy, political behavior, and they fuel the crisis and create an opportunity for the spreading of civil war in the country. I'm going to base some of the things I'm speaking to you about from two large survey projects, which is a survey I conducted on the Maidan in between November 2013 and January 2014, as well as a larger panel survey that we conducted in 2014 with my colleagues, Henry Hale, Tim Colton, and Nadia Kravitz, but also of field work. So we conducted 300-plus rapid interviews with the protesters. I conducted, actually that number is a little bit higher, but many interviews with political insiders, and I'm going to be focusing specifically on the Party of Regions, or the pro-Russian party, and other things that inform the stuff I'm talking to you about today are focus groups and archival documentary analysis. So let's turn to the first myth. Ukraine is a divided country electorally, ethno-linguistically, into two even halves. Anyone who's Googled anything about Ukraine has probably seen this map. It couldn't be more wrong than this map, but because ethnic and linguistic identities do not overlap neatly in Ukraine. You can be a Ukrainian ethnically, but your mother tongue can be Russian. You can speak Ukrainian at work, but in your personal life, you might speak Ukrainian. So this doesn't work in any way. Okay, let's now just turn to the electoral divisions, because it does seem like this has been the case, and we've seen it over and over again. Yes, two halves. But Zhytomyr in the middle here, Zakarpattia in the west, and Kherson in the south. They seem to be kind of outliers, and they statistically are, in fact, from their neighborhood, right? So it's not so clean cut. Furthermore, if you do any serious analysis of the electoral outcomes over the past few years in Ukraine, you see that there are in fact four different regions, and that these regions, they have more similarity and they're overlapping, so they get messy. And of course, Kiev International Institute for Sociological Studies does make the argument that we should look at Ukraine as west, center, south, and east. Okay, so it's not evenly split. But perhaps the thing that irks me the most, and especially in the recent analyses of Ukraine, is that really we're talking about two polar islands in Ukraine at opposite ends of the country. And we seem to focus almost all of our analysis, including predicting voting behavior or foreign policy preferences, on what these two islands believe. When you start looking at the electoral data, you do see that Lviv and Donetsk become important islands. Go back to 2010, you see again Lviv and Donetsk become important islands. So let's turn back to the language and ethnicity. Unfortunately, we have really bad data for Ukraine. This does help a variety of individuals, because you can say almost anything, and it potentially is true. But the last census we have is 2001, and what we know is that mother tongue, or native language in Ukraine, is 67.5% of the country, whereas Russian mother tongue is 29.6. So the majority are considered mother tongue Ukrainian speakers. When it comes to ethnicity, and this is the 2001 census result, this is a 2015 estimate from my colleague at Harvard, ethnicity is somewhere between Ukrainian ethnicity 78% to 86%, and Russian ethnicity is somewhere between 17% to 8%. And this actually it's not because people have moved necessarily, or Crimea doesn't come into this number. As I said, these things don't overlap neatly. So we've heard the term Russophones very often, and certainly this is what has been justified in the beginnings of this conflict, that whether it's the separatists or whether it's Russia, protecting Russophone people, Russian speakers. And certainly if you map this, and this is from Matas, you can find it on Wikipedia, it's an infamous map now among people who study Ukraine, because certainly if you map this out, mother tongue speakers, you get this picture. And then you're like, oh yes, that's exactly where the conflict is. This makes complete sense. I buy it. Why not? The problem is, most people don't speak their mother tongue on a daily basis in Ukraine. If you really want to be serious about talking about Russophones in Ukraine, this is how it looks like. This is actually remodeled by my research team, Henry Hale, Tim Colton, and Nadia Kravitz and I. So where does the conflict end then, if that's your... These are people who consume Russian news sources. These are people who speak Russian on a daily basis. So it's not as clean cut as we'd like to make it out to be. Let's turn to myth number two, pro-Russian politicians. Is there really such a thing in Ukraine? And they have these vested interests that are very stable over time, and these are tied to Russian politics and industry, and this is why Yanukovych did not sign. Well, I'm going to do something that a lot of academics do all the time, yes and no. This is a quote from a Party of Regions insider. I obviously cannot tell you who it is. Unfortunately, Chatham House rules, but I can say this is a guy who knows. And Yanukovych did not sign the November Association Agreement because of pressure from Putin via Medvedchuk. Medvedchuk was considered to be a kingmaker in Ukrainian politics since the 1990s. And this name will come up in a few next slides. But it's also because he was in conflict with other oligarchs and because he tried to create this mafia-style family network thing. Okay, so this is why it's a yes and a no. But to be clear, Ukraine has been ruled by oligarchs since its independence. And an oligarch is an oligarch, whether it's somebody from the Donbass, right here, from Kyiv, from Dnipropetrovsk, or from Western Ukraine, who's the current president, by the way, Petro Poroshenko. An oligarch is an oligarch. Everyone came to be an oligarch because they had to do creative things to get there. The problem about what we think when we think of pro-Russian politicians in Ukraine is that we are actually a little bit mistaken. There's no this very nice united group, okay? This is a divided East, and it has been historically divided between two major, people refer to them as clans, I think it's just best to refer to them as clientelist networks, but based in the Donbass region, which is Donetsk and Luhansk, and Dnipropetrovsk. Dnipropetrovsk, and this is Natakvetov, who would be with Yanukovych, and is certainly of the Donbass clan, and this is Dmitry Firtash, who made a large donation to Cambridge University, if you aren't aware, from the Dnipropetrovsk clan. And he's also a wanted man, and I can't remember if he's currently in prison in Austria or if he got bail, but yes. Okay. And these two networks were constantly, not only in the industry, but in politics, they were in constant competition. And if you, this is a plug for colleagues of my book, if you really want to know about Dnipropetrovsk and start understanding the roots of Ukrainian political power, I urge you to read Rock and Roll in the Rocket City by Sergei Zhuk. Dnipropetrovsk was, for the Soviet Union, the center of Communist Party intelligentsia and military power. Okay? It was an incredibly important city historically and continued to be so. It's a different type of criminal network and oligarch network kind of person that comes out of this. And who's been part of this? Yulia Tymoshenko, Kinchuk, Kuchma, Kolomoisky, Firtash, a variety of the most important names in Ukrainian politics and industry. Donetsk is a little different. Donetsk actually starts off with a boxing ring, criminal ring, sorry. So it's a little different, but they end up in the same place. But they weren't friends, they were in constant conflict. What happens with the Party of Regions is actually former President Kuchma is able to unite these competing factions in Ukraine. There was no united pro-Russian East Ukrainian political thing before this. And he's able to bring these two people together into one party, and with the help of this guy, Medvedchuk, okay? That was their little project, and it was an experiment that was very successful at first. Unfortunately, because there were long-standing conflicts, it was not as successful as they hoped. And after the Orange Revolution, even after the election of Yanukovych to the presidency, there were very serious splits in the Party of Regions. And the splits would be on things that would surprise you if they're supposed to be the pro-Russian, and we're talking about pro-Russia party. There were splits specifically over Georgia and Maidan. Okay? But here's a quote from, again, a member of the party just after the presidential elections in 2010, where he told me there are so many conflicts and divisions that the opposition only knew. He went on to explain how weak the party truly was. Some want to professionalize and open to markets, citing Akhmetov as the guy who wants that, and be accepted in London on the cultural scene, which would be Kinchuk. Others want to maintain the status quo, which would be Yanukovych. And I don't want to make fun of this situation, but really, money matters to these guys. They care about money, even though they have billions. And if you, many of them have told me, where did they get the majority of funds? This is just foreign direct investment into Ukraine as a percentage, annual percentage. It comes from the EU. Many of these oligarchs wanted access to the EU markets. If anyone tells you otherwise, it's wrong. Okay? They funded activists to travel to a variety of the EU negotiations, including Akhmetov's foundation. And this is what one person said to me. Again, if he is a member of the former Party of Regions. Not only is the EU market better for selling certain types of goods, it also just makes sense.
If you think about it, why would he, referring to Akhmatov, want to risk prison or worse? He, like Kolomoyskyi and Pichuk, want to stay big fish in a small pond and not get eaten alive by the shark. And he's referring to the fate of several oligarchs in Russia. So there were people from within the party that certainly were pro-Russian in orientation or wanted certain type of foreign policy. But we cannot say that they didn't want the EU. And just a side note, which wasn't planned, but I'll tell you anyway, President Kuchma was actually the person who got EU accession proceedings started. Okay, he is perceived as, he's linked to the death of journalism afterwards. But that's not certainly the story we tell people. And it wasn't Viktor Yushchenko, the Orange Revolution king, that actually made the most progress. Viktor Yanukovych, until November 2013, made the most progress on EU accession that any president in Ukraine has in the past. Okay? So this actually turn in November is surprising, and it was surprising to his colleagues. What about Poroshenko, the current president? You know, is he not a Western Ukrainian? Is he not pro-EU? Yes, he is. But his history is equally as complicated. He was first elected into parliament actually as part of a party that's headed by Medvedchuk, and I told you that this name will come up again and again. He was actually a founding member of the Party of Regions, the big bad pro-Russian party. Yeah?
Here he is.
He moved to Yushchenko's Our Ukraine shortly before the elections because he saw that this was the horse to back. Then he backed Yatsenyuk's Front for Change in 2008. Now they're in a terrible conflict. He's the prime minister currently, so that's an interesting fact. And he was in Azarov's government when Yanukovych was president as the Minister of External Affairs. Okay, so he has ties to pro-Russian networks if we want to perceive things in black and white. So this guy, Medvedchuk, he comes back in, and he is this truly, if you want to believe in the pro-Russian versus pro-EU thing, he is that guy. Yeah, he really is. And have a Google what he did in his past. And he resides quite often in Russia, and he's a personal friend of Putin. And he has, in the past, at least 15 years, been able to exert a great deal of pressure on behalf of Putin in Ukraine. So that's where that comes in. But all the rest is far messier than you'd like to admit. Myth three. Euromaidan is nationalist, to put simply. Now, I did a lot of research into this because protest politics is my thing. And we made sure that this time around we were on the ground speaking to the protesters as they were protesting to not lose or cloud their opinions of why they turned out. And I've already written up a great deal of this, including with my co-author, Gwendolyn Sasa. So I think we can group it into three groups. Students and youth under 30, they talked about EU accession. They talked about global human rights, freedom, fight for democracy, these very abstract things. The median protester, which was the majority protester, talked about economic security, better opportunities for their children, visa restrictions, desire to live in a normal democracy and human rights. And I'm not quite sure what a normal democracy means, but this was repeated so many times that I can't now report it. And protesters over 55, again, talked about corruption, injustice, and human rights. The demands shifted between socioeconomic claims, the things that the protesters wanted, socioeconomic betterment of their lives, and civic and human rights grievances, the abuse of their rights. They actually talked very little after November 30th about the EU. Okay. And little, if any, mention, I cannot find any mention of any ethno-linguistic claims, nothing about language policy, and many of these people spoke to us, obviously, most in Russian. But this just did not come up, and currently in focus groups, I think it's 12 now, it's not coming out. People are not using that language. So I cannot tell you that that's the story, because it isn't. But they were divergent constituencies, and we really have a democratic diversity problem with the protesters because they want competing demands, European reforms in education, liberalization and lower taxes, and higher pensions. Well, anyone who knows anything about politics knows that no politician can probably promise any of those three things together. Myth four, they were all Western Ukrainians, Ukrainian speakers, and Russian speakers in the East were completely out of the picture. So this is the survey that we conducted on the Maidan between in Kyiv between November 26, 2013 and January 13, 2014. They were older than we initially thought. The average age was 36. And they need this thing as recently a parliamentarian quoted that figure back to me in my own article, so that's nice. Researchers getting out there. They were more likely to be men. And this is, I asked what their mother tongue was, what language they used at work, and what language they used in their private life. So we tried to get a big, better measure of these things. And I did it wrong, but I'll tell you why in a second. So they're actually predominantly Ukrainian speakers, no matter which way you slice it. There is a very large group that are saying that they are predominantly Russian speakers. And then there's these people who say they are bilingual. Now, this is the problem with my survey. I never gave them an option to say they're bilingual. But this many reported that they are. So if I gave them that option, I'm assuming that more of them would have taken it. And you unfortunately learn on your own skin when it comes to these things. It's also because people weren't putting this in surveys in Ukraine for the past few years. There's no consistent methodology on these questions. That's not actually interesting, and I'll explain to you why that's not that interesting and not surprising at all in a second. But what is interesting and surprising is that they were all in full-time employment and they had a higher level of education. Really, we should understand them as more likely to be middle class. Okay? That's a better way of understanding them. Now, why am I not concerned about the language reported? Because they were mostly from Kyiv. They were not mostly from Western Ukraine. It should not surprise anyone who has studied the Arab Spring or past protest events anywhere. If protests happen in a big city, most of the protesters are from that city and the surrounding areas. Why would we assume that most of the protesters are from the outside, unless you really truly believe the binary black and white realities of Ukrainian political history? Yeah? 57% are from metropolitan Kyiv or Kyiv Oblast. In my survey, we have about 3% from south and east, other central another 3%. West, 16%. We do have this group, 21%, unknown. We don't know where they're from. But Tamila's already heard this before. But anecdotally, we can tell you that when we conducted rapid interviews, the people from Western Ukraine told us, I'm from this village and this address. Are you writing that down? Mm-hmm. And of course, you can't write it down in the survey. Yeah? But that's how very proud of the location they were from. Easterners and Southerners would tell us they're not from here. I'm not from here. I'm from far away. And they didn't want to say where they're from. I'm assuming that some of them are in here. We can model for that. All I need to say is that I think this is going to be distributed as much as this, because I think we did do a good job in the randomization when approaching protesters. Now, I don't understand why people keep talking about Ukrainian speakers and Ukrainian nationalism when it comes to these protests, when the so-called leaders of these protests are not typical. And I'm putting up, including a radical right-wing organization leader here. Mustafa Nayyem, the guy who said he's supposed to be the father of the revolution, he is in fact an Afghan immigrant who's a Russian speaker. Okay? He is a Russian speaker. He wrote the first post in Russian on Facebook. Sadiq Nigoyan, the first death, who is now considered a hero of the protest, he's Georgian ethnically and was a Russian speaker by his family's own account. Dmitry Yarosh, the leader of the right sector, this radical right-wing organization that popped up during the Euromaidan, he is in fact a Ukrainian speaker. But he was perceived, including by a friend, Lukin Wei, and others, as a Western Ukrainian. He's not. He's from Russian-speaking Dnipropetrovsk, which is in the east, which, if you remember, that was one of the main groups in the Party of Regions. Yeah? That's where he comes from. Many radical right-wing Ukrainian nationalist organizations have their roots in central and eastern Ukraine. There's a variety of explanations for this, including power threat theory, but that's not what we're going to go into right now. Why we want to say things that when they aren't true, I don't know. But how about the Ukrainian national imagery that we found? You wouldn't find that in the east, and I really did think so, and I'm not going to put any of the more radical stuff right now, but even this is considered too Ukrainian ethnically to be found in the East. And I believe this. I really did think this as well. I've done a great deal of research in Donetsk and Kharkiv in the past, and I thought this was also true, that people wouldn't drape themselves in flags until I did the research, because this is actually from Donetsk. And this is happening actually a little bit later. This is a rally when the separatists were in motion, and this is a rally against Russian intervention in Ukraine. Where about 20-something thousand to 30,000 people joined in. Largest ever protest in that city. period. But why I further do not believe this story, and why I really want you guys to think about this, is that there were Maidans in the region. They were not only in the capital, and they were not only in the west. And there was certainly a Maidan in Donetsk. But there were Maidans in Luhansk, there were Maidans in Kharkiv, there were Maidans in Dnipropetrovsk, there were Maidans, 2,000 people marched in Crimea. There were Maidans in Odessa, in the south as well. Okay? These were the biggest protests we've seen that weren't organized by political parties. All right? Because we have the Facebook to prove it. So here is a quote, and I did interview a variety of activists from Donetsk. And here's a quote that one of the activists said to me. So, people stop by each and every day to tell us that they are with us. They said molodzi, which we can translate as way to go, good job, guys. It's actually a person, but I don't know how to translate it correctly into English. Then they went to work. Grannies came from the market, gave us a duvet. Some stopped by and gave us sandwiches. In 2004, Orange Revolution, people wouldn't dare to do this. This time they were with us. When the conflict started, they all came out. Donetchane, sorry, came out in support of Ukraine. They were in the thousands. Okay, this is a rosy version of that reality. I happen to have a variety of photographic and video evidence of how many people there were there, but these things did happen, and that was unheard of in the past. It was unheard of that people from the market would walk over and bring a kovra. It was just, these things didn't happen in Donetsk. People were very fearful. And this is actually a Yevromaidan ribbon from Donetsk, from one of those activists. They started their Maidan on the first night, on November 21st, even before the repressions. Their numbers grew after the repressions because different types of people joined in. An activist really wanted to stress this point. There was more fear in the past. This time it was different. But to be clear, not everyone was pro-NATO, pro-Ukrainian language. They wanted to get rid of Yanukovych. And this is not different to the protesters in the east. This is what we find pretty much amongst all protesters. After the 30th of November, they stop talking about the European Union, and they talk about repressions and Yanukovych and a corrupt regime. And this is a rapid interview with a protester from Donetsk, and we were lucky enough to actually get one in December 2013. And I wish I could find this woman now, but I have no idea what her fate was. She told my interviewer that, "I'm not sure about the EU, but those could have been our children that they beat up. That could have been my son. I want to live in a normal country." So much like those people on the Maidan in Kiev, they're using very similar language. And she's as ordinary person, ordinary citizen as it gets, yeah? So at least, I hope you believe in that. Myth number five, Russian nationalist and separatist sentiment in Crimea and Donbass. It was there, sure. Why would anyone deny that? Russian nationalist parties were not a new thing in 2014, but they never received much support, and the minimal support that they did receive was in Crimea. And this is why we, when understanding this conflict and how it has been so different in these two different parts of the country, this is going to help us understand this. So there's a variety of them. I'm not going to go into them. There's this one, Soyuz, which was established in 1997 in Simferopol in Crimea. Website features a lot of this guy. I still with the Ukrainian. It's all very confusing. I don't understand what they're doing now, but they're there. For Russian Unity, which was originally called Russian Movement of Ukraine, it was represented in the Crimean Parliament since 2006 in Sevastopol only. It did try to run in national elections in Ukraine, but received no seats even in Crimea. And this is a similar story for the rest of them. One Rus was at some point called Party of Putin's Policy. I mean, if you're going to, it's maybe clever. But again, at the national elections, was not able to win any seats, and it only competed in Crimea, okay, in these three places. Russian Unity, they all sound very much the same, did win only three seats in Crimea in 2010. You would assume that they're probably the most successful. And they did compete in the Ukrainian parliamentary elections. Again, no seats, and also only competed in those particular cities. So they were there, they competed, they had minimal support. But even in Crimea, where they should be getting much higher support, if you think of fringe parties, how they can rise over time if people truly feel under threat, like UKIP, why weren't they able to attract more voters if truly, as we are meant to believe, 68 or 70 something percent of the population voted in favor of something? I don't know. It's a question. In the Donbass, you had something called the Slavic Party. It was established in 1992, right off the bat. It was established by former Prime Minister, Yanukovych, Azarov. It was targeting the Russophone population in Ukraine, but it died out very quickly, and I can't find any traces of it after about 1995. Although its founders and key members were very prominent figures in both Kuchma's and Yanukovych's governments. And they really didn't have much local support. Now, Donetsk Republic, this must sound familiar to you, the People's Republic of Donetsk, the Donetsk People's Republic, I can't remember which it is translated in English, but this is the origins. The origins were in 2005, following the Orange Revolution, as a reaction to the Orange Revolution. These guys, there was about six of them initially, they did organize in Donetsk city center, and they did aim, as they are aiming today, for the special status of eastern regions of Ukraine. And very few people joined their rallies in the past, up until 2014. The estimate is about 30 to 40 people at any particular rally. And they were ridiculed in the local press. And that I find fascinating, because the local press was in fact controlled by the Party of Regions, which is supposed to be the pro-Russian party that actually incorporates people like this. And this was a map that they produced in 2006 about which regions they were talking about, just to give you an idea of their aspirations for the spread of conflict. But we need to bring ordinary citizens into the equation, because it really doesn't matter what a few political elites are doing, right? Setting up parties and the like. So if you look at, this is a quite blurry image. If you look at survey data over the last few decades, and this is survey data provided by Kyiv Institute for, International Institute for Sociology, who we work quite closely with, and these were compiled by my colleagues at the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute and Nadia Kravitz, my co-author. And as you can see, percent of respondents supporting unification of Ukraine and Russia in 1995, this is too blurry for you guys to see, it's much of the country is somewhat supporting, so at least this is about 30-something percent, the lighter blue. As you go through time, this very much changes. By the time you get to May 2013, there's very little support for the unification of Russia and Ukraine, so this is all under about 35%, okay? And this is bad, but this is not the greatest, those who do stats, this is not the greatest showing of data, but I think it's the best we have right now, and I couldn't find something better at this time. But of course, what happened after the protest, we see a difference, yeah? Yeah, we see a difference. In the places we expect to see a difference. But Crimea is in fact extremely different. Now, you don't have the numbers here, and Crimean support was in the 60s for unification of Russia. This was under 50. So how do we jump from that to conflict? So there was still, even in February 2014, there was still far less support for this in the Donbass than we would expect following this particular mass mobilization that was seen as divisive and scary. This is now from our survey data that we collected just before the presidential elections. In May 2014, and we see that the number is just over 50 in Donetsk, but it's still around the 30-something percent mark in Luhansk. Okay. So this is when the conflict is well underway. It's not this overwhelming support that we would, and we obviously we have no data for Crimea at that time because we aren't allowed to conduct a survey there. Okay, now I'm going to do something which could be considered anecdotal, but hopefully over time, the more interviews I conduct with these people from Donetsk, the more I will be able to tell you. I have a few people from Donetsk Oblast and Luhansk Oblast that have been acting as my informants now for 2 years. And they go back to Donetsk and Luhansk, and they go back to their relatives and neighbors and try to collect information and data for me. There's a certain amount of this work that I can do, but it's very limited because of, and I can explain why a little later. There's one particular woman that brings back this paraphernalia for me to read, and I meet with her either in Kharkiv or in Kyiv, and I will not say who she is. She collected a variety of fantastic things, but these four following documents are from what may be my favorite Donetsk around.
She is a lady in her 80s. And she is the neighbor of my friend's relatives. She is anti-NATO. It was the Nazis who were protesting in Maidan, yeah. She is, you know, a hardcore supporter of a variety of things, and she is the target audience of the separatists. She is the target audience of those who would want the reunification of these two countries, right? Except she's brilliant. This is documents that were handed out to individuals when the conflict was starting. The green men were handing these documents out. And she, with her critical mind, started making red marks on them. There's a variety of things I won't go into, but it's a lot of these question marks. And in some of the points she says, who are you? I've never heard of you before. Are you from here? You're not us. What Ukraine? Russia's way? Like, this is, she's a perfect target audience. I have her recorded. I can't share this with you. Her life is in danger. She still lives in this region. But it is fantastic that even the people that were supposed to be the target audience of the separatist act are not necessarily falling in line. That doesn't mean that some people aren't. But the sad reality of this conflict is that we misunderstood a variety of things, led to a variety of really poor policy decisions, both by Ukrainian politicians and Russian politicians, on the base of these half-truths, binary realities, and so on and so forth. And this conflict produces people like this individual who feels like they are a citizen of nowhere. She is not a citizen of Kiev's Ukraine. She does not see herself as such. But she is not a citizen of Putin's Russia either. She's, of course, elderly. It's actually quite impressive that she has avoided a variety of ill health and also the effects of war. But there are more like her. And these are people that are younger, these are people that are middle-aged, and so on and so forth. And I think Kyiv is equally missing the point on these guys when trying to resolve this conflict. Not only is Russia. So final myth, Ukraine is a failed state.
It isn't, it's still around. Everything that's happened in the past 2 years, it should have been a failed state. All of our political science theories and IR theories have told us that it should be completely. It's successfully run multiple elections, even in conflict-ridden zones. The fact that it has loads of problems, that's true. But the divisions between ethno-linguistic groups continue to grow and remain the most salient predictor of policy preferences, political behavior, and fuel the crisis. So now I'm not going to show you any of the statistical results or tables right now because obviously I'm done time-wise. But we cover a variety of this with our survey research in Ukraine. And we found that when questionnaires, as I explained to you initially, when questionnaires are extended, when we ask multiple questions about language, about identity, and so on and so forth, the results are also different, and mainstream assumptions and expectations about ethno-linguistic salience prove either incorrect or incomplete. Now, those of us who study Ukraine through the lens of civil conflict, focusing on ethno-linguistic conflict, really should evaluate this one more time. So this is from two papers that are forthcoming. One is on electing Poroshenko. We found, surprisingly, that Ukrainians are not rallying around nationalists. They are not rallying around the flag, and they are not reacting to, we had a variety of list experiments and such, they're not reacting to ethno-linguistic claims as we would like, and even in the places where we would expect, on either side of the spectrum, yeah? They did elect an establishment politician, including some like Poroshenko with past ties to so-called pro-Russian parties. And surprisingly enough, they're voting, so we managed to capture them right before the presidential elections, right after, and right after the parliamentary elections. And surprisingly enough, their voting behavior and policy preferences are fairly stable. And of course, they seem to be fairly stable also with what they said they voted in the past, but I don't know how much we can actually trust that. But even as conflict worsened, the conflict escalated over the summer of 2014. The parliamentary elections took place in October 2014. We would expect ethno-nationalist claims
to resonate more in parliamentary elections for a variety of reasons, even because of the way that you vote and how you have contact to certain. It hasn't. Foreign policy preferences have also been stable and have not shifted and have not grown more radical.
That's a surprising finding. In other research, we found that the identities that motivate political behavior or policy preferences, including how Ukraine should deal with Russia, have, I think, shifted to what could be understood as a strong sense of a unifying or common civic identity. That we think that language and ethnicity seems to matter a lot for the majority of Ukrainians. It seems that we're wrong. That for the majority of Ukrainians, statehood matters a great deal. They themselves find them, they are themselves conflicted because they may have family in the East, they may have family in Russia, but something about Ukrainian statehood is very important to them. And we're doing a variety of focus groups to try to figure out how that works. But region and not ethnicity and language seem to trump almost everything. When we do statistical analyses, and it's whether positive views of the Euromaidan, foreign policy preferences, language policy preferences, wanting Russian to be also a state language, or past voting behavior, we find that age and education matter greatly. It shouldn't be a surprise. The people who are older and the people who are less educated have more radical points of view on either end of the spectrum. They're Ukrainian nationalists and they're Russian nationalists. They have more radical perceptions of what to do, preferences on what to do about the conflict. But region and not language or ethnicity, or even past vote, are the most important in predicting people's, whether people believe that the Euromaidan was positive or that Ukraine should join the EU. Okay? So language and ethnicity become important when they interact with region in our models, not when they are used in themselves. And that's very important, again, for those who study ethnic conflict. Now the problem is that in order to find solutions to the conflict, okay, we have this age and education variable, so I think we can do something there in our understanding of how this works. But really, and to prevent further escalation, we need to unpack what it is about the regions. We still don't know. And so now a lot of people are going back through the decades of survey data that we have, unfortunately can't go back and interview or conduct focus groups, but to better understand what is this region element. Because it seems to be so central to Ukraine and we seem to have missed the ball completely by creating these binary myths, inconsistent truths, and reproducing them over time. There is something there. People in the East have different views. People in specific oblasts in the East have different views. We're finding that people in specific constituencies, towns and villages, are more likely to have certain views in these places. If you're going down further down, you have really bad data on this. I don't know what it is, but it's something important. It might just turn out to be an economic inequalities argument, which may be interesting, maybe not interesting, but it's important to know when we're dealing with conflict, and one of the most serious geopolitical conflicts in Europe that we have seen in years. So thank you very much.